Welcome to Dreamland, a program dedicated to an examination of areas in the human experience not easily nor neatly put in a box. Things seen at the edge of vision, awakening a part of the mind as yet not mapped, and yet things every bit as real as the air we breathe but don't see. This is Dreamland.
It is indeed. And I wasn't sure where my mic was there for a second. Hi, everybody. Welcome in. Good to have you. It is Sunday evening once again. Dreamland underway. A couple of heads-up items for you. I'm Art Bell. One heads-up. We were going to have Zachariah Sitchin on a regular syndicated program, Coast to Coast AM, but Zachariah Sitchin, because of events in Israel, will not be with us this coming week, but rather the following week. So look for Zachariah Sitchin, a lot of people waiting for him, 1 a.m. on Thursday morning, the 15th. That'll be on Coast, and I'm looking forward to it. Coming up shortly, Linda Howe, and then Dr. Chet Snow, back from France. We kind of get him once a year as he comes back from France, on past and future life progression and the possibility of multiple lives. A couple of other items. I would like to give out my World Wide Web address. It is a simple one, unlike many others. It is www.artbell.com/art/. That's it. A lot simpler than most of them. That's www, standing for World Wide Web, artbell.com/art/. And I also want to thank the gentlemen who have that page up. It is one of the best pages on the web, and it gets constant attention. Also, the absolutely astounding pictures from Hubble. We have got what we think are the two best ones of all the ones sent to me. And they are on our bulletin board, entitled star1.gif and star3.gif. When you get into our bulletin board, you simply hit J space 11 and go to the section that says Hubble. You will find them in there. star1.gif and star3.gif, and they really are worth having. If you have an inkjet or laserjet printer, you can print them, and they are then of frameable quality. Creation at work. I've got an Associated Press story, and a lot of people, thousands, are seeing a face in the clouds. Of course, it's kind of a cosmic Rorschach test, but a lot of people claim they're seeing the face of Jesus Christ. I haven't seen it yet, and I've been looking. Maybe I just haven't seen it the right way. At any rate, tonight's show, in a moment, of course, Emmy Award-winning investigative journalist Linda Howe, who is at home in Philadelphia with what I understand is a fascinating report regarding some new alien footage, Roswell footage, I believe. And then Dr. Chet Snow on past lives and future lives, and you know I love that topic. So we'll be into all of that here in a moment. If you suffer from headaches, backaches, sports injuries, any kind of discomfort, Philadelphia and Linda Howe. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Art. It's Socorro, not Roswell, according to the cameraman. And a couple of brief updates before I get into the humanoid autopsy footage story.
All right.
Last Sunday, I interviewed a Red Bluff, California man who watched three strange-looking helicopter-like vehicles fly 50 feet above him and his growling dog.
Yes.
He said that all he could hear was a slow, whispering, whooshing sound.
He made a good little whooshing sound.
Right, and it was sort of...
That's right.
Afterward, I received several calls for two or three days from pilots who said even new helicopter designs which reduce noise aren't that quiet. So what were those objects? I continue to look forward to anybody's information on that issue.
All right.
And the Lassen County, California Sheriff's Office called me again about a third mutilated cow found on the Barton Ranch in Susanville. Tall grass that we collected from the first two mutilations a couple of weeks ago has been examined by W.C. Levengood, the biophysicist in Michigan. And Dr. Levengood told me this week that he found the same pattern of biochemical and biophysical changes that he has found in plants from other animal mutilation and crop circle formations that I've reported about on Greenland for the last 2 years. His hypothesis is that an intense and complex energy was focused at the sites, but the technology and motive are still unknown.
All right, well, let's settle something then right now. This seems to me a good way to settle it. You know our two friends over in England with their chains and board, right?
Doug and Dave.
Doug and Dave. If Doug and Dave were to do their thing with a chain and board, would the kind of changes that Dr. Levengood found be apparent?
Absolutely not, he says. He says that the mitochondria changes in the cells would never be affected by simple physical force of feet and board.
Okay, that really is important, Linda.
Yes.
For people to understand, because, you know, Doug and Dave were only the beginning, and I'm sure that some crop circles have been created by Doug and Dave wannabes.
But certainly not all of them, and not worldwide.
And not with these biological changes.
Yeah, in the cells themselves.
Exactly.
Well, the humanoid autopsy footage from the alleged May 31st, 1947 UFO crash near Socorro, New Mexico, was in the news again, this time in Dusseldorf, Germany. Magazine publisher Michael Hesseman organized a conference last weekend to discuss the controversial story and to screen other Socorro footage and film that is beginning to emerge from a variety of sources. For the first time, an uncut 14-minute version of what is called the Socorro tent footage was shown.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, and in the audience was Bob Shell, editor of Shutterbug Magazine for the past 8 years, and the author of that first report, which we've discussed, that supported this autopsy film as being consistent with 1940s black and white high-speed film.
Now, everybody should know Bob Shell, who I interviewed on Coast, did photo analytical work for the FBI and for a lot of other people. He is not a lightweight.
That's right. He's been in photography and doing the magazine for 24 years and editor the last 8 years on Shutterbug. He knows a lot about film and cameras.
Right.
And yesterday, I interviewed Bob about what he saw at the Dusseldorf conference, including the unedited tent footage.
And what you can see is a being that looks similar to the one seen in the autopsy, lying on a table, maybe it's a cot, in a dimly illuminated area, which may be inside of a tent. You can't really tell it's a tent, it's a dark area. There's an emergency lantern hanging directly over the table that the creature's on. There's two people behind the table, and for convenience, I'm just calling them medical technicians because that seems to be what they are. They're wearing white lab coats like a medical technician would wear. And the creature's not moving, at least not visibly moving. I didn't want to have someone look at this on the computer and see if any chest movement can be detected.
Does the head seem the same? Does the size seem the same?
The head. It's not very clearly lighted, but the head does appear to be the same kind of a creature. Based on the height of the two people behind the table, just guesstimating height, it looks like this creature is larger than the one we've seen in the autopsy that's out on video.
Taller? Longer?
Longer, taller, yes, that's right. And
do the feet stick out of
the feet stick out from the bottom. It's covered by a sheet, or a white piece of cloth anyway. The feet stick out at the bottom, the head sticks out at the top, and the right hand and part of the right arm stick out on the side.
And how many fingers and toes?
Now, the tape that we saw wasn't clear enough to count the toes. The feet are fairly well shattered anyway. The fingers are hard to see, but I'd say 95% sure that there are six of them. I tried several times counting them, and it always looked to me like there were six of them. The head does have the big black eye covers like we've seen in the autopsy, so it appears to be the same kind of creature, but it appears to be a taller member of the same type of creature. According to Phillips, he who has seen both autopsies as well as the 10 footage, the creatures in both autopsies appear to be about the same size. That one, again, something larger. So we do have on film three out of the four creatures that were supposed to have been at the crash. It's really impossible to tell exactly what these people, these medical technicians, are doing to this creature. But it looks like what they're doing is removing a fairly large quantity of wet, dark cloth. It could be surgical gauze saturated with a dark fluid like blood. It could be some other kind of cloth that's already dark in color. But if you assume they're medical technicians doing some kind of medical procedure, then it looks like what they're doing is removing a wound dressing, preparatory to perhaps replacing it with fresh dressing. And if they are in fact removing a wound dressing, as saturated as the material appears to be from the way it flops around when they lift it up, I'd say that the creature had lost a considerable amount of fluid. But this is really speculation, because we really don't know exactly what they're doing. It's just an impression of what they're doing. The other piece of film that surfaced at Düsseldorf that I did see, because it surfaced the day I was there, is some film that was brought to Düsseldorf by an Italian man by the name of Bongiovanni. Mr. Bongiovanni received this film from a friend of his in Brazil, and this film shows a crashed disc-type flying saucer on top of a military flatbed truck. Wendell Steves, who was at the conference, said that this was a standard issue military flatbed from the 40s, and that the bed of the truck measures 40 feet long, in which case the saucer is about half, the diameter of the saucer is about half the length of the trailer, which means the saucer is roughly 20 feet in diameter. The first sequence on this film shows the saucer on the back of the truck being supported vertically by some scaffolding. Second sequence shows it inside of a hangar, and again, Wendell says the hangar has every resemblance to being a hangar at Wright-Patterson from his days of being there. And the third part of the sequence shows some large object being hoisted out from inside the saucer by chains. And this large, strange-looking object is identified as the power plant of the saucer. All I can say about this film is that it looks good, in the sense that if it's a fake, it's an extremely well-done fake. Mr. Bongiovanni says that he can get the original film. What he had with him in Düsseldorf was a videotape made from the film. And if he can, in fact, get the original film, then we can go to work on verification of it also.
Can you give a little bit more detail on the object that is on the film? Is it lens-shaped, egg-shaped? What is the shape and color?
It's the traditional saucer-shaped flying saucer, the one that looks like two saucers placed together. It's very shiny metal. It's a black and white film, so we can't tell color. But it's very shiny metal. It is smashed in on one side, apparently from impact. It has a rip in the surface skin on it also.
Can you see anything hanging out of where it's ripped?
The area where it's smashed in, you can see quite clearly the internal structure, which is a lattice work of what look like metal I-beams. The I-beams look like they're probably similar to the I-beams we've seen in Santilli's film in the debris sequence. A very complex lattice work of I-beams and a metal skin stretched tightly over it is my impression from looking at it. You can't really see inside the saucer because it's quite dark in it. And then again, there's this sequence of this very strange looking object being hoisted out on the chain hoist. It's not something that looks like anything I've ever seen before.
And this new tent and UFO footage art might reach the United States in the next few weeks, and I'll keep reporting on this story as it unfolds.
Absolutely amazing. And now we find we've got a picture of the saucer itself. Holy mackerel, and maybe the drive for it.
Yep.
This is amazing. It's got to be one of three things in my way of thinking. Now, you see which one you believe it is. It's either got to be a fraud done in 45 to 47, which seems very unlikely.
Right.
Two, the real thing. Or three, some horribly gone wrong government experiment. One of the three. Either way, no matter which you look at, it's a big story.
Well, I keep remembering Bob Shell telling me that he called up a former colleague from his days long ago at the Central Intelligence Agency, described the six-fingered, six-toed being in the Santilli autopsy footage, and that this old colleague now...
First-time callers, area 702-727-1222.
That's finally out. I think that more than one person off the record has been coming forth to me and to others saying this footage is real. So I think we should hold the door open that the biggest irony of all time, that we're being introduced to a non-human intelligence through autopsy footage in old 1940s film.
All right. Linda, we're way short on time, so give everybody your contact information.
Right. The number to call if anybody has information on the animal mutilation, dark helicopter connection, or these strange vehicles in the air is my office tomorrow at area code 215-491-9840, or fax area code 215-491-9842. And for people who would like information about my documentary and book productions, please call the toll-free 800 number, 800-707-9993. That's 800-707-9993.
All right. Linda Howe, thank you. We'll look forward to talking to you next week, and the plot thickens.
Oh, it does, Art, and give my best to check snow, because prophecy is a big deal now also, and they just had a big conference in Philadelphia last weekend.
All right. Linda, thank you. Linda Howe, Emmy Award-winning investigative journalist, and by the way, what I took out, I eliminated expletive deleted. She was referring to the government source, and she said his comments were, S-word, you mean it's out. So I wanted you to be sure you got the context of what was said. She actually spelled out the S-word, so I took it out. I just wanted you to know exactly what that was. Back in now, Dr. Chet Snow, and Dr. Snow has a doctorate, of course, in sociology, as well as one in history. And a very good opening question for the doctor would be, well, I guess, first of all, welcome back from France and welcome back to Dreamland.
Thanks, Art. Good to be here.
An opening question would be, with two doctorates and a zillion different possibilities of areas that you could investigate and, you know, work you could do and no doubt teaching you could do and all the things you could do, how in the world did you get into the field you're in?
Well, sometimes you have to get hit over the head. And actually, something similar to that happened to me about 12 years ago. It was actually late 1982. Two things happened. I was working for the United States Air Force at that time as an administrative officer in their historical department, mm-hmm. out at Travis Air Force Base in California. And enjoying that very much. Had really enviable lifestyle. I got to fly around the world and the country a lot and do very interesting things when two things happened. One was there was an industrial accident that happened to me at work that led me to, find that the medical establishment couldn't solve and cure everything that they and I thought they could do, and spent a good deal of time with a problem of what's called phantom back pain.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure you've heard about that. And
oh, no, I have it.
Yeah, okay. Anyway.
I fell off a pole, and L4 and L5 got compacted, and I've been sort of a back problem ever since.
Well, I had a major problem with that, and then the second thing that happened was, as I've told many people now, that my grandmother, with whom I was very close, and who nonetheless was 90-some years old, passed away. Only what happened with me was that she refused to stay dead. And, you know, Raymond Moody has written a whole book about this now, so it's become a fairly well-known, popular topic. He calls it reunions, and he says it goes way back in time, and you can sort of go to one of his places, he puts a fancy Greek name to it, and get in touch with dead relatives and things. Well, I didn't need any of that. What happened with me was in an Air Force VOQ unit, that's a visiting officer's quarter unit, on one of my missions, about 3 weeks after her passing, she suddenly just appeared in the room.
Mm.
Walked right out of a ball of light at the foot of my bed. And
In what form? I mean,
Looking very much like I had known her, only a few years younger, and looking obviously in much better health than I had last seen her before her passing. And in fact, what was fascinating to me, these encounters, these sessions, you could call them, I guess, went on for a couple of months, always very discreetly, always in appropriate times and places, when I was alone, when I wouldn't be bothered, and it didn't matter what time zone of the world I was in.
It happened in America,
in Japan,
yes,
in the Philippines, in Hawaii, I can't even remember how many different places, but always at an appropriate moment for me, and in each time, she had something personal to tell me, something that was interesting in a family kind of way. And then, little by little, she began to give me some instruction, and I'll just say it really simply that we have a very limited concept of what we call the afterlife. It isn't just sort of you're here and suddenly you either go to heaven or to hell.
Mm-hmm.
That's very kindergarten style.
All right, just before you go on, I want to ask this. Did you question your own sanity at any point?
Oh, at the beginning, I sure did. And I think she knew that because not too long after these things started to happen, she actually recommended a clinical psychologist to me.
She did?
She named the woman and told me where she was, and it turns out that she was Dr. Helen Wambach, who was at Berkeley at that time, not very far from where I lived in Northern California, and was a specialist in reincarnational work. And so, obviously, I made an appointment right away, and that's how all this got started, because it was Dr. Wambach who more or less coined the whole concept of future life progression. She was one of the pioneers in that area.
So when you told her this, what did she say to you?
Well, I didn't tell her it right away, as you can imagine.
Okay.
I called her up, and I didn't say, my grandmother who died 3 months ago gave me your name and address. Not
right,
quite.
Right.
She gave me her name and a basic address, and then someone actually came to me a few days later, just an acquaintance, started telling me about Dr. Helen Wambach in Berkeley, and of course it didn't take too long for me to figure out that was the Helen that my grandmother had been mentioning. So what I said to her was that I had been recommended by a very highly placed source. I remember that very well. Highly placed source. And Helen Wambach had a wonderful sense of humor because later when I told her the whole story, of course, she laughed and remembered that first situation.
I'll bet. So you sort of snuck up on it with her.
I snuck up on it with her, and in fact what happened was she suggested to me, I told her that I was having some problems in my career and this back injury was bothering me and that I wanted to know more about her work, and also that I had been recommended to her. She had been recommended to me, I should say. And so she said, well, let's see. Let's do a regression and, of course, find out if there's some history, some background to any of this.
Mm-hmm.
So this started essentially a two-year relationship that ended when she passed on from a heart attack rather suddenly. But in that time, we did, I would guess, maybe 25 or 30 regressions and ultimately progressions, because I went to her not knowing she was dealing with this future stuff at all. That only came out after we had worked together for a while. And in the initial sessions, I found that in fact, I had known my grandmother before several times. In fact, that she had been a close family tie to me, maybe even more than some of the other members of my personal family today. That may be why she came back to me instead of some of the others. There were some things that needed to be ironed out that came out clearly in these sessions. And that basically she came back to remind me that before I had been born, I had kind of made an agreement that I wouldn't spend my whole life just working in dusty Air Force records, which, although by today's terminology, I guess we're finding out disappear anyway, especially when congressmen want to find them, right?
So it would seem. I'm curious, very curious about this. What did she tell you, and what did you find out about the very nature of life after death?
Well, clearly the first thing was that, surprise, surprise, you don't just disappear. And it's not just a big sleep. That very much, as I later learned in the near-death experience report, you have this incredibly wonderful sensation of being out of the physical form, although you feel you're still in your body. And yet, if you look around, you can find where your body is in most cases. And you are in, and the interesting thing she said was her reaction was, I'm trying to get it right. I said, I'm not nearly as pretty as I thought I was.
Well, I would imagine if you were old, frail, and ill when you passed away, it would be relief to be out of the physical body.
Right, but the whole feeling was, in a sense, that it's like you disassociate a little bit from the physical form, and yet you know you're you, and you're still very much yourself. In fact, all of a sudden, all the ailments and ills and pains are gone, and it's
all right. So you're suggesting this is a period of consciousness and awareness.
That's right. And then essentially she said that she was very quickly, she didn't go through all the stages, as far as I could tell, of what near-death experiences go through. She said for her it was very quickly, almost like a flash of light, and she found herself no longer involved with where she had been in the hospital and that kind of thing, and that she was initially like high above the earth and could see out to the whole universe. And then it was almost like thought, as Edgar Cayce said it this way, thought becomes think. And where she would think is suddenly she could sort of be there watching it.
You have not yet seen, I know because we talked before the show, the photographs just taken by Hubble, 7,000 light years away, the actual creation process underway, stars being born, these 7 trillion or 6 trillion mile long gaseous clouds birthing stars. It's the most incredible thing you've ever seen in your life. And I wonder if when we die, if in some relationship with our universe, we get to understand and behold these things.
Well, I think I can answer that. You not only get to behold and understand such things, she also said that suddenly she was inside a snowflake, and that was a universe just as big and brilliant as being outside watching the Earth.
That's an interesting comment. There may be, I suppose there are, many universes of many sizes.
And yes, that's right. And size is very relative, isn't it?
It really
sure
is
what we think.
It sure is. Our Earth, relative to what's around and out there, is but a speck.
Yeah, yeah.
Barely detectable speck.
That's right. And at the same time, it's a speck, and yet what she was saying was that one outside of the body can fill all of that in an instant of thought. And that, I guess, is something like knowing the mind of God, you might say. She, by the way, was a Methodist and then a Baptist. She was a daughter of a Methodist preacher and married the son of a Baptist minister. So that gives you some concept
yes.
of where she started out from.
Well, there are a number of things that I don't understand about the kind of work you do. In other words, if she was conscious and aware after death, then at some point we move from that to another life.
That's right.
So then it's a sort of at least a partial or conscious erasure.
Not exactly. Oh. There is almost like an agreement to let go, and a sort of an understanding that almost like an actor in a play has to take on all of the characteristics of the role of the character they're going to play, but then when they go home at night, they're the actor, they're not that character. Well, sometimes you get so much into your character while you're doing the play that you begin to take on actual thoughts and characteristics and formations of that character, and that hangs on with you a certain period of time, but as a consummate actor, when you're finished, when that play has done its Broadway run, let's say, well, you're going to start preparing a new one. So there is some in-between time, you might call it, between the two. Now, what she was telling me was she was still very much involved with her identity as who she had been here, and that is, in a sense, what brought her back to me. I guess she thought of me. I had been thinking very strongly of her after her passing, and essentially she wanted to let me know that, first of all, that she was fine and she was all right. And this is one of the things that loved ones often need to know. And a lot of communication, more or less, is really for this purpose.
All right. What I want you to do, we got to take a quick break
sure.
here. But when we come back, what I would like to know is how you are so sure, so that experience you had with your grandmother was, in fact, your grandmother and not some unknown segment of your own mind settling out with itself, so to speak. So anyway, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to Dr. Chet Snow on Dreamland. I once had a cat. This is going to sound stupid to a lot of people. I don't care. I once had a cat named Yesu. Yesu was my closest friend. And Yesu died in my arms. And there are times when I have felt this cat's presence around me. Now, I have no way of knowing, really, whether this presence that I feel are the memories kept alive in my mind and the longing that I still feel for this pet of mine that I was so close to. And so, Dr. Snow, I'm going to ask you, in essence, the same question with regard to your grandmother.
Sure.
How do you know? What part of this was so real and so certain, or what anecdotal proof is there that your grandmother was not a figment of your imagination?
Well, a couple of things. Of course, how can you have hard physical evidence of something that isn't a physical phenomenon? That's obvious and clear. But two things stand out to me. One was that there was a consistency about these contacts, these sightings, these appearances, these times, I guess you could say, we had together. They went on for several months, and it was a fairly regular thing, so it wasn't like a flash of light and then suddenly, oh my gosh, that's my grandmother, I'm thinking of her. I actually did have somewhat of an experience like that when my own mother passed away. Many years before, actually, I lost my parents when I was only in my 20s. And that was, I don't know, except that I felt very clearly, closely, it was her. With my grandmother, this went on for some time. The information that she kept giving me included things that I couldn't possibly know about.
For example?
Well, I'll give you a list. I didn't even know it. Nobody knew it. This little Baptist lady. And she didn't want my aunt to see these books. So she told me they would be in the linen closet and they would be for me, and that's why she'd come to me to tell me to pick them up, please, and not show them to my aunt.
That would do it for me.
Well, they were there.
They were there.
One day there, and the weirdest thing is, Art, I actually forgot that that's what she told me until we started going through the apartment and my aunt said something about the sheets and the towels, and then it was like, oh my God. And then I thought, oh, well, what do I do? And I said, yeah, okay, I'll take some of those. And went in there, and there were about a half a dozen paperback books of various spiritual topics, including faith healing, and a book on Edgar Casey, as I've mentioned, the medical psychic, Olga Worrall, a very famous healer, Ruth Montgomery books, a very interesting a little selection that I still keep as a, you know, my one of my most treasured memories. And the final thing was, is the last time she came to me, which was about 3 or 4 months after this all started, she came to say goodbye, which isn't something that you might just think in your mind. And she actually looked younger at that point than when I had ever known her. And I don't think I'd ever even seen a picture of her at this age, which was about, and then I asked her how old she was, and she said, it's when I got married, and that's the age that I always like to think of myself.
Yeah, I wonder if in the afterlife, we start out at the age we die and begin to get younger until we're born again.
Well, what she said to me, and I asked her a little bit, not quite that way, but she said to me, we can be the age we want to be until we choose to release this image.
Really?
And the body's an image, from the spirit's point of view.
How long does one remain in such a state, quickly, because we're about at the top of the hour here?
Anywhere from a minute to 100 years.
That's quite a span.
It depends on your need and the illusion that you have to keep creating.
Well, it seems to me at the moment of rebirth, consciousness is mostly sacrificed. And so I would think people would not easily give that up. But that's, of course, a very mortal, earthly perspective. Dr. Snow, stand by. We'll get right back to you. Relax for about 7 minutes and stay right there. From this mortal perspective, why you want to, you hang on to consciousness, seems to me, as long as you can. We'll be right back soon. The future.